Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a minute, our conversation today with a high school teacher who turned to a former student to investigate the death of his son in Iraq. But first, speaking of Iraq, there is still a lot of work to do here. That comment from President Obama after he flew into Baghdad for a surprise visit today, arriving just hours after a car bomb exploded in a Shiite neighborhood of the city. Ned Parker of the Los Angeles Times is in Baghdad. Ned, it sounds like it's still too dangerous to list Iraq on the itinerary, but was this a surprise?
I think it was expected within the Iraqi government and certainly the embassy. I mean, there were plenty of whispers and speculation would say that President Obama would come here because of the importance of Iraq for his administration, his wishes to draw down U.S. forces.
What is the president doing on the trip?
Well, he's meeting with General Odierno, and according to the latest pool reports from press traveling with President Obama, Prime Minister Maliki is going out to the Baghdad International Airport, Camp Victory, where Odierno is based. So I assume they'll be talking about the broader strategic questions of how much can you draw down U.S. forces, how viable is it for U.S. forces to be out of cities by the end of June, which is stipulated under the U.S.-Iraq Security Agreement signed in November.
You mentioned Camp Victory. The president, we understand, is expected to speak with some of the U.S. troops stationed in the country and some of the injured, and awarding medals to several. Just a quick your sense, you interact with the troops, your sense of how they might feel about his visit.
I think the President of the United States is a symbol of America, so if you're serving in the military, to have the President come out and meet with troops and give medals to soldiers, I think that's a huge morale boost. I think it always has been and continue to be, whoever the president is.
And what should we read into the timing of the visit? It's coming at the end of his first major foreign trip, the G20 summit, the NATO meeting. And, you know, he spoke in Turkey about Iraq as an example of the change he seeks in policies he inherited. What do we see in this?
It's significant he's visiting now. There's an acting U.S. ambassador, but you don't have the new ambassador in Iraq yet. So much is up in the air. I was talking with an Iraqi official the other day who made the point that whether President Obama wanted it or not, he will be judged on this war, this war that he inherited. And the perception at the end of the Bush administration was that after many mistakes, the United States had helped stabilize Iraq. That was the perception through the surge. So while President Obama wants to draw down troops, and even when he's spoken about, you know, having all combat forces out of Iraq, combat brigades by the end of August 2010, he's also said that that can only happen if it's viable. So for the president to be in Iraq today, it shows his commitment and I think recognition that what happens here will affect how his administration is judged. I mean, it would be very easy for people to come back and say, oh, President Obama, he threw away the gains of the surge. And certainly in the last few days in Iraq and this past month, there have been indications, examples of how fragile Iraq remains, how easy things could fall apart.
He told the students in Istanbul in Turkey regarding Iraq that he was very much against it, but now that we're here, withdrawal has to be done in a careful enough way that we don't see a collapse into violence. And you're writing that yesterday was one of the worst days of violence in Baghdad this year, 37 people killed in bombings yesterday, and as we said, another car bombing today. Your sense of that uptick in violence?
In Baghdad yesterday, what was really shocking about that, you had six car bombs go off throughout eastern Baghdad and a few in western Baghdad. And that, you know, spoke of some form of organization, planning, and that raised, I think, the threat level in a way that we just had not seen in a few years.
Do you think the bombings yesterday were sort of directed at Obama, who yesterday was just north in Turkey?
No, I don't. I mean, there was speculation he would come, but also you have to, you know, April 9th is the anniversary of the fall of Baghdad to the United States. Today is actually the anniversary of the formation of the Ba'ath Party in 1948, I believe. So the attacks are probably more linked to Iraqi politics than Obama.
Ned Parker of the Los Angeles Times in Baghdad. Well, Private First Class David Sherritt of the Army's Vaunted 101st Airborne was 27 years old. He was from Acton, Virginia. He was in Iraq. He was killed in a firefight north of Baghdad on January 16, 2008. That much everyone agrees on. But how did he die? The Army initially said it was enemy fire from insurgents thought to be unarmed. But David's father, a retired and still beloved high school Shakespeare teacher, suspected all was not what it seemed. With the help of a former student, witnesses on the ground, and other parents, the senior David Sherritt doggedly investigated his son's death and discovered the troops monitoring the incident from the air knew the insurgents were armed and didn't relay that to the troops on the ground, and that the unit's leaders who boarded a Black Hawk helicopter and left the scene while David lay wounded included the lieutenant who'd mistakenly shot him. David Sherritt's father of Private First Class David Sherritt joins us from his home in Virginia. Of course, says so sorry for your loss.
Thank you very much.
And we also welcome James Gordon Meek, who covers national security for the New York Daily News. He joins us from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor in Washington, D.C. Welcome to you, James, as well.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
And Dave, can you start with what the Army told you about your son's death?
We originally were told by our casualty assistance officer a couple of days into this that Dave was killed. It was a friendly fire incident. And before we buried him at Arlington Cemetery, that was vehemently denied by Lieutenant Colonel Robert McCarthy in a phone conversation I had with him from Iraq. So we did not know it was friendly fire until the spring of 2008.
Well, we want to hear about how you came to confirm what actually happened. But before we do that, we have a real description of what happened from you, James Meek, because you got your hands on a reconnaissance video, an infrared video that was shot from a drone while this incident was unfolding. Tell us, what did you see?
Well, it was the video that we obtained, which was a classified video, two of them actually shot by an Army drone that recorded the entire firefight, and also Air Force jets that were also flying overhead that recorded much of the incident. And what the video shows is that about 5 a.m., an eight-man team from the 101st Airborne lands with POC David Sherritt, led by Lieutenant Timothy Hansen, and they get off the bird, and they are directed to a thicket where the six suspects are hiding. And apparently nobody thought that this might be an arms cache, and as it turned out, it was an arms cache. Yeah. The Air Force had detected they were actually pulling something on. That was the quote. Turned out to be ammunition belts.
And you can hear this on the tapes.
You can. You can hear an Air Force, somebody's in the Air Force looking at this infrared video saying they're pulling something on. Photographs of the insurgents that we obtained later show that they were putting on chest racks with banana clips for their AK-47s.
You're watching this on the video. You're watching these troops, including your former teacher's son. Circling this thicket. What are you thinking?
Well, as you watch them form a circle around the thicket, which, you know, I think the technical term for that is circular firing squad, the crossfire potential just was obvious looking at it. You just want to scream at them. You want to scream, you know what's going to happen next, and you just want to scream, run away. And all you can do is hit pause on the recording.
Yeah.
And they just seem so relaxed. They just didn't know what was about to happen. And at 5:16 a.m., the thicket just explodes with gunfire in every direction. And everybody sort of is either blown back or jumps back. And two of them are killed almost instantly, PFC Danny Kimmy from Fisher, Illinois, and Corporal John Sigsby from Waterville, New York. And Dave Sherritt, PFC Sherritt, jumps back, breaks right like the star football defensive end that he was, and he sort of jumps down to the side of the thicket. They didn't know he was there. And there he remained for 4 minutes, watching, in part, his roommate, Sigsby, killed an arm's length away from him. And then at 5:20 a.m., he obviously made the decision that he had to get out of there. And you catch a glimpse of PFC Sherritt as he is sprinting away from the thicket, firing his M4 rifle directly at the enemy. And at that moment, Lieutenant Hansen tragically mistook him for a terrorist and pulled his trigger and shot him. Right about 6:10 a.m., the firefight ended. And that's when Lieutenant Hansen got on board this helicopter with two wounded who he was not treating and flew away.
Dave Sherritt.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry for you to have to hear this again.
It's all right.
But it's what you now know happened. You heard it from troops who'd been there. Then you had to force an army investigation. James found the tapes and other documents. You both worked with the parents of other soldiers, including Doug Kimmy, the father of Danny Kimmy, who'd also been killed. You quote Shakespeare to say, "You were your own band of brothers." But the army kept describing the scene and saying, including in one email from a colonel, that it had been enemy fire.
I hooked up with Doug Kimmy and shared this email with him. And Doug, who was a policeman and quite well-trained and versed in tactics, and an ex-Army man himself, Air Force, I believe, and he served in Vietnam, looked at this from a tactical point of view and just couldn't believe what he was reading.
What were some of the mistakes? Let's mention them. James already talked about encircling a thicket, which almost ensures that there's going to be crossfire. But what were some of the other mistakes made?
I think the first mistake was going in to begin with. It was rushed. There was no need to go in. These eight guys are dropped off. There's no backup. It's a known tactic for these guys to stash weapons and go find them and then use them. And our men are told that they're unarmed.
And the other thing we understand is that it was just before dawn. It was very dark. And they weren't wearing infrared lights.
It's a simple little beacon that you plug it into a 9-volt battery, and it emits a flashing light, which is only visible to other troops wearing night vision goggles, and it marks you as a friendly, as they say. The lieutenant admitted in one of his sworn statements that he had not allowed his men to take the time to attach these things to their gear. And the sergeant has admitted that to me, who led them in, that they were just sort of, they were real pumped up to go get these bad guys.
So Hansen couldn't see whether this figure moving was friend or foe. And then later, David, when your son was lying there, the troops that were back on the ground with him, who didn't get on the helicopter, couldn't find him.
They couldn't find him, but as James has pointed out, he was clearly visible from the drone.
And that's
that
right.
Information was not being communicated to the people on the ground.
This is one of the outrages of the Army's investigation, is that they ended up, rather than faulting, they faulted the lieutenant to some degree, but they also faulted these troops for not putting on their infrared lights, or beacons, if you will. His officer admitted that he didn't give the order, nor did he give anybody time to do it, but to say that that's why he was shot and that's why they couldn't find him for 25 minutes when they had a drone overhead with an infrared camera that clearly showed him lying on the ground for 30 minutes of videotape that I have. He actually lay there for 73 minutes total before he was actually found and people started to administer CPR on him. He had a faint pulse. They could have used it to walk in the searchers right on him within 30 seconds, and they didn't do that for whatever reason. But to then blame the victim is an outrage.
We want to note, there were also heroes in those final moments, particularly First Lieutenant Timothy Cunningham, also left behind. He tried to save Dave, and Cunningham would also be killed in Iraq 2 months later. We're talking with James Meek, military reporter for the Daily News, and former student of the senior David Sherritt, whose son died. When we come back, what should happen now? Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to Here and Now. David Sherritt is a retired English teacher in Virginia. His son, Private First Class Dave Sherritt, was killed by friendly fire in Iraq in January of last year. David's former student, James Gordon Meek, reporter of the New York Daily News, helped David, the dad, investigate what happened to his son. The Army initially denied it, but then this past summer admitted that David had been mistakenly shot by his own lieutenant, who then left David on the battlefield and was promoted to captain on his return home. Now, Dave Sherritt, this outrages you, but another troop leader, Staff Sergeant Chris McGraw, who's apologized profusely to you, said that Lieutenant Hansen had a meltdown. Can you understand this might have been the fog of war?
I have compassion for him. I have compassion for his family. I want somewhere in the midst of all of this for there to be redemption out of this. Because I think about him, I think about his family. And I don't want bad things to happen to people. Having said that, my son is lying for 20 minutes bleeding, and the man who was leading him into battle leaves him there. For me, that's the ultimate act of betrayal. Dave did what he was trained to do. Lieutenant Hansen apparently lost it. That's fog of war stuff. Yeah, I buy that. I have no idea how utterly chaotic, what a masterpiece of confusion this thing was. But he got on this helicopter, he evac'd, and my son may be, I'm not saying he would be, but he may be alive had somebody been there to say, that's where Sherritt is.
James, as we said, you were a student of Dave Sherritt's, and you knew his son.
Before Dave got remarried, he was a single father. When I first met him 25 years ago, I was in his freshman English class. He also later taught me Shakespeare and philosophy. And, you know, there were times when I guess the babysitter wasn't available and the kid would be in class and my classmates would take turns, you know, looking after him during the day. And he was this wonderful little kid who would play at our feet, and he was just adorable.
You called him Bean.
Yeah, we called him Bean. And he was the light of Dave's life. And as I wrote once, we had all taken turns looking after him, and when he grew up, he looked over all, watched over all of us.
You mean because he enlisted?
Because he was a soldier.
And of course, this soldier to you was still Bean, the little kid. And you were a child to his father, your teacher. But then, as you're saying, all the roles get reversed. So, James, what was it like to be called on to help your former teacher, who, in your earlier years, we understand, spent some time trying to keep you on track?
Dave was one of the most remarkable instructors I've ever had in my education, but he was also a really good friend. He was like a big brother to me. He thought all my sort of goofy teenage stuff was endlessly amusing for some reason. But I thought I was helping him maybe a little bit get through his son's deployment. I had no idea. I never imagined that I would be counseling him to deal with the aftermath of his son being killed and then dealing with what I would call a cover-up by the Army, trying to whitewash something very uncomfortable for them, which was a friendly fire shooting.
Yeah. Dave Sherritt, what you taught James, in part, was Shakespeare. And I'm just wondering if you find solace, something to help explain this story, if there's some way you go back to your work, I mean, to help you reason this.
To be very honest with you, all of the literature, all of the drama, all of the poetry, all of the short stories that I taught really didn't prepare me at all for the crucible that I went through, that my wife and I went through, especially together, and that our kids went through. There's no preparation for this kind of thing. It's one minute you're talking to your students, the next minute you're summoned to the office, and you have no idea what for. It's just you've got a visitor down there, and then you're looking at this man who's got something to tell you, and I had to get it out of him, and all of a sudden my world has changed. It's just dramatically gone hard left. Having taught all of these tragedies, these comedies, Death of a Salesman, Heart of Darkness, and I think maybe in looking at the way everything shook out, maybe Conrad the most, Heart of Darkness, I kept on thinking this is a sordid farce acted in front of a sinister backcloth, a touch of insanity in the proceeding. I couldn't believe that we had to pursue what really happened the way we did. It's taken well over a year, and that's what this is all about, was giving Dave the voice that he was deprived by the men he served and took orders from.
But I've been very struck by what you've been talking about in recent days, Dave, when you've been quoting Othello. Rest perturbed spirits,
yeah,
rest.
That's from Hamlet. That's from Hamlet.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. That's all right.
Mistake.
He's still the teacher, James.
Yes. I've been corrected. I just got the big red pen in the sky marked my paper.
What was the Hamlet?
It's rest perturbed spirit rest. It's when Hamlet is talking to his father's ghost. I had to do this for Dave, and I can't imagine my son's asking me when they begin to look at this and said, well, Dad, why didn't you push to get the truth in this? I did it for them. I did it for mostly to give Dave a voice. Because that's how I raised him.
Well, it's just I got a chill. I guess I need to ask, do you, Dave Sherritt, think that your son's perturbed spirit can now rest?
You know, I think, as I said to my wife the other day, I believe this is the beginning of the end. And James has just been such a consummate professional and the most exceptional friend. I couldn't have done it on my own. Who am I? I'm just a retired teacher who wants to play golf every once in a while, and maybe teach again. But I had somebody who had the reporter's instinct, the investigator's instinct, who was as varsity a reporter as you could possibly want.
Well, he had a good teacher.
Oh.
That teacher's Dave Sherritt.
Yes, I did.
He's speaking to us from his home in Virginia, and his student, James Gordon Meek, who covers national security for the New York Daily News. He's been speaking to us from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor in Washington, D.C. He helped conduct an investigation of Dave Sherritt's son's death, which the Army has admitted was a friendly fire death in Iraq. I want to thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Robin, thank you very much for the opportunity.
And when we return, the latest news and the rest of the program, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The death toll from Italy's worst earthquake in three decades is now over 200. Hopes are fading for finding more survivors, and rescue crews digging through the rubble by hand today were jarred by a strong aftershock. The quake took a severe toll on the town's prized architectural heritage as well. Many Romanesque, Gothic, Baroque, and Renaissance landmarks were damaged. Cracks appeared in monuments as far away as Rome. Meanwhile, thousands of people are living in sports centers, army barracks, and shelters following the quake, which measured 5.8 on the Richter scale. The BBC's Dominic Hughes has this story for us from L'Aquila in central Italy.
In a sports field on the edge of L'Aquila, a long queue of people are standing waiting for their evening meal. Many of them have been here for hours. It seems safer here in a wide, empty space compared to the narrow streets of the old town further up the hill where the buildings totter. It has been a long and terrible day for these people, one which started at around 3:30 in the morning, as university lecturer Laura Di Michele explains.
Last night it was really awful. You know, my bed, it moved from the, you know, from the wall towards the center of the room, so I just got up quickly as I could, just put on some, you know, clothes and went out in the street, and I stayed in the street in my car, and then I saw my brother, my sister-in-law and other friends since 3 o'clock in the morning. I've been going round because it's impossible to go again into the flat where I live.
Not everyone was so lucky. Across the town, scores of buildings succumbed to the force of the earthquake. A four-story apartment building was reduced to what is now a pile of broken rubble and twisted metal. The roof has crashed right down on top of the collapsed building. A mechanical digger is clearing the way for dozens of rescue workers who will now sift through the ruins by hand. They've already found two bodies here, and they expect more will follow. Inside a hastily constructed field hospital, Dr. Gaetano Pellini guides me through the treatment for the walking wounded. Camp beds line the walls. Most of the people being treated here seem to be elderly. The worst injured have already been evacuated to a local military base and then onto regional hospitals. The town's own clinic was too badly damaged. But Dr. Bellini says the problem now is logistics.
There are people that we know who no longer have health problems, but they need to be moved to emergency accommodation, where they can live and get food. But many of them are finding it hard to abandon this area because they have friends and family here.
Nearby, some volunteers catch their breath after a hard and terrible day. Andrea Marconi, a local soldier, says the situation has been extremely difficult.
It's pretty critical because there are a lot of people here and we don't have the vehicles and the infrastructures to provide assistance for these people. We try to make our best, but it's pretty hard.
It's a pretty difficult situation.
Yeah. Critical.
And a tough night ahead too for those thousands unable to return to their homes. Many have already left town for hotels in the surrounding regions or to stay with friends and family. But others, like Laura Paolini and her family, have chosen to stay.
Our house seems not to be in too bad shape, but no, we can't go back in. They told us not to go back in, so we've been out here. Well, they've got tents up for people. We're going to sleep in our car.
Well, I've now walked up the hill to near the top of the old town, and a continuous stream of emergency vehicles are flying past on the road. But the town below me is in darkness. Almost all the buildings are deserted. Most of the streetlights are out. With aftershocks still being felt, it's just too dangerous for the locals to come back. But the emergency workers are battling on, knowing these are vital hours if any more lives are to be saved.
That's the BBC's Dominic Hughes in L'Aquila, Italy. For updates, go to hereandnow.org. We'll be back in half a minute with a woman who has one of the most amazing memories in the world. A doctor asks, why? 30 seconds, here and now. Welcome back. Do you remember what you had for lunch yesterday? How about what you had a decade ago on the same date? 44-year-old Jill Price can remember that and other mundane details of her life. She has an astounding ability to recall things, including major historical events and television storylines. Here's Jill Price on ABC News last year with a stuffy-nosed and hoarse, but it is her, Diane Sawyer.
When was J.R. shot on Dallas?
When he was shot, or when did you find out who shot him?
He was shot
on March 21st, 1980, and we found out November 21st, 1980.
What about Nancy Kerrigan attacked?
January 6th, 1994.
Oh, Lord, you're right.
Researchers at the University of California, Irvine, studied Price's memory for a decade and coined a term for her condition, hyperthermestic syndrome, Greek for exceptional memory. But cognitive psychologist Gary Marcus of New York University wondered whether Jill Price wasn't the woman who could remember as much as the woman who couldn't forget. Gary joins us. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
You decided to meet and study Jill Price, and she was amenable. You wrote about what you found in this month's Wired magazine. How unusual is it for someone to be like her, to seem to be able to instantly recall information from a specific date?
It turns out there are a number of people that are at least a little bit like her. Since her case has surfaced, the scientists that have studied her have had three other people come forth with very similar syndromes, and they have a whole list, I think, of 50 or 100 people that they're interviewing to see if they might actually have the same kinds of symptoms. So she's not unique, but she may be more talented at this than anybody else.
Right, talented, that's a key word. And you say that for a mind to actually work with the precision of a computer, a very binary, here's the event, what's the date, that would be, as you say, an evolutionary leap.
That would be. So when I heard about her case, I was a little bit suspicious. Not that I thought anybody was necessarily being dishonest, but the way that the story was presented was really that she could remember absolutely anything.
Right.
The way that human memory is constructed, that seemed very implausible to me.
Well, and we just want to make clear, she isn't like Kim Peake, the Salt Lake City savant. Dustin Hoffman's character in Rain Man was based on him. Many journalists have met Kim. I met him. He knew every date in my life. You know, he could name every date in my life. He's a savant. That's a little different, isn't it?
That's right. Jill's not autistic. She's able to have ordinary conversations with no trouble. So one of the things that I did was I actually brought a set of questionnaires so that I could do basically psychological kinds of experiments on her to see what are the limits. I wanted to push how far. You know, could she remember absolutely everything? The place where I found that she had the most trouble is the same place that every other human being has the most trouble, which is that if you have a long list of similar kinds of things, you tend to confuse them together. So in a computer, every memory is listed separately. But in human brains, our memories kind of bleed together. And I was really curious to see if that would happen with her memory, too. And so I gave her lists of words like needle and thread and so forth, and she would wind up remembering that she heard words like thimble. And so there was a kind of same blurring going on in her memory as anybody else.
So she didn't have that kind of memory where she could spit back a list you'd given her.
Her memory for new material isn't necessarily different from anybody else's, which is a clue to what's really going on. It's not that she somehow has a photographic memory or that she has a perfect memory.
Well, but she, for other scientists, could spit back the exact date of the explosions of the space shuttle Challenger and Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. In other testing, she recalled what she'd done on every Easter since 1980. For instance, April 6th, 1980, ninth grade Easter vacation ends. 1981, 10th grade, new boyfriend. You say that was a clue. What was the clue?
Well, the memory that she has really turns out to be personal history and headline news. So she's not good at history in general, for example. My favorite line in the Wired article is a quote from her where somebody asked her, when was the Magna Carta signed? And she said, do I look like I'm 500 years old? The thing is that her memory is autobiographical. And so the things like the plane crashes, which she happens to be very interested in, fit in with the autobiographical. So she just happens to be really interested in plane crashes, and she happens to be really interested in her own life, and she knows those things very well. So the question is, why does she know those things very well?
Well, and what's the answer?
The answer is that she does something that ordinary people can do called elaborative encoding. Elaborative encoding is this idea that when you think about something and relate it to other things, you start to remember it better. And she does that constantly. She talks about having a split screen in her mind. She's always talking to you. She's present in the conversation. But she's always thinking about what else happened on this particular day. So you cycle through a year, and she will have thought about every November 22nd that's happened to her, every November 23rd, and so forth. So she keeps practicing everything. She gets them very well organized. She's not necessarily doing this deliberately. In fact, I think she's doing it compulsively. One of the themes in the article is that she seems to have a lot of OCD-like symptoms.
Well, and this is where you start to sort of break open the story of Jill Price. She keeps diaries, and some of it is reprinted in the Wired magazine article, incredibly detailed diaries about every single thing that happens to her.
That's right. She has 50,000 pages of diaries. By structuring her life around dates, she's fascinated by dates and numbers and so forth. She has some of the same characteristics as someone like Kim Peek. She has much better social skills, but she has some of the same kind of obsessive, ruminating, thinking about things over and over again, the same thinking about dates and numbers and cycles and so forth. And so she just practices these things a lot.
In fact, her brain was scanned more than 2 years ago.
I haven't actually been able to see the brain scans. The scientists who did those scans haven't published them yet, and they're not yet willing to share them. But my understanding from Jill herself is that the structures that you would associate with memory, like her hippocampus, those seem to be perfectly normal. What seems to be different are some brain structures that are associated with OCD. And I think what's interesting about people with this syndrome is they don't really want to do it. It's not that Jill wants to be the memory queen. It's just happened because she has an uncontrollable urge to keep thinking about what's happened in the past.
Well, so obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. A lot of people spend years in therapy trying not to obsessively go over their life stories and their past and, you know, maybe fix it, you know, if they've got a problem. I mean, this is sort of the basis of problems.
For Jill, it's a source of pain, and that was part of why the media glommed onto her story, was this idea that, well, if you have a gift, you must have some corresponding suffering. For Jill, it's very difficult to move past these memories.
Given that, you know, there is all this emotional content for Jill, what did she say when you very tentatively tell her what you think is going on with her?
Well, that was the most interesting part of the conversation. I spent 2 days with her, and on the second day that I saw her, I went in to watch her at work. She kind of wheedled it out of me. She wanted to know, what did I think of her? And I sort of didn't know exactly how to explain it. And then it turned out that on that very day, an article came out in the Wall Street Journal about her. And it quoted the scientist that had studied her talking about this very idea of elaborative encoding, how if you want to remember something, you take photographs of it or you write it down in your diary. And I explained that this was her in spades. This was exactly what she was doing. And she's a very bright person, and she could see how it fit. I'm not sure she liked the way that I described it, but she understood it.
Well, what's she going to do now? Because, as you say, it's a mixed blessing for her. And, you know, we know that she had some pain in the past. Her husband died shortly after they were married. Is she going to get help to stop it or learn to live with it?
I actually asked her, you know, would she like to be like me? The other thing that happened during the interview is she kept asking me, well, what happened on, you know, November 10th, 1996? And I would have no idea. I was always completely clueless. She doesn't really want to be that way. I mean, she thinks, you know, in some way we're impaired compared to her. So she's willing to take the pain and suffering in order to have this feature that really defines her. So it's a struggle for her. But I think in the end, she'd rather keep it.
But what does it do for you as a cognitive psychologist? How is it going to help you in your work?
I found it to be a fascinating case because I've been thinking a lot about the nature of memory. So it was a really interesting test case to see the extremes to which human memory could be pushed and still to see the limits that are there. It's a way of looking at the parameters of the human condition.
Gary Marcus, cognitive psychologist at New York University and also author of Kluge, The Haphazard Construction of the Human Mind. Gary, thanks so much for speaking with us. Fascinating story.
Thanks.
Coming up, vegan soul food with a soundtrack. How about listening to this, the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble, while cooking collard greens? Coming up here and now. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Well, it's too hot to sleep. I'm too cold to eat. I don't care if I die now.
So you say you want to have a taste of good old-fashioned soul food, say ham hocks or chitlins, better known as pig intestines, which is why maybe you shouldn't invite your vegan friends. They don't eat meat, poultry, seafood, eggs, dairy products, and some don't eat honey because they believe it enslaves the bees. So what's left? Well, how about baked barbecue black-eyed peas with chipotle chili and adobo sauce and a little bit of Bill Withers on the side?
You can really swing and shake your pretty thing.
Self-described eco-chef Bryant Terry loved soul food as a kid growing up in Memphis, and he's now figured out a way to have his vegan cake and eat it too, complete with a soundtrack. You might have seen Bryant as a guest chef on BET. He also hosted the PBS series The Endless Feast and co-wrote the book Grub, Ideas for an Urban Organic Kitchen. Now he's put together a new cookbook called Vegan Soul Kitchen, fresh, healthy, and creative African-American cuisine. Recipes come with recommendations for reading, a soundtrack, and art. The Black Eyed Peas page suggests taking a look at Brett Cook Disney's portrait of James Baldwin. Bryant Terry joins us from the studios of the University of California, Berkeley. Bryant, it is a cultural tour and a tour de force.
Thank you, Robin. I'm glad to be here.
It's really quite something. Soul food without barbecue. Was this challenging?
You know, it wasn't a challenge for me because the focus was simply on fresh, seasonal, sustainable, good food. And, you know, most of my cooking is ingredient-driven. The food that I grew up eating, that my parents and grandparents grew up eating, was as local as our backyard garden, as fresh as being harvested right before the meal. Whatever was in season, that's what we ate. And I really wanted to help people living in the South remember this legacy that I think so many have lost over the past four decades of eating fresh, good food and kind of replacing what has been the fast food treadmill that so many people have gotten on.
Well, let's take a soul food staple, collard greens. In a recipe called Citrus Collards, you add raisins and a little bit of orange juice. And by the way, we'll link you to Bryant's website to get more information. But one of the soundtracks you suggest is by the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble.
Yes, it is.
Okay, so let's listen to a little of Sankofa from them while you tell us what to do with citrus collards.
Citrus collards with raisins was the first recipe that I invented in this kind of reinvention, remembering of Southern African-American cooking. And rather than cooking them for 2 hours in a big steel pot, as I often had them growing up, I decided to cut them into a chiffonade, which is thin strips, blanched in a big pot of salted boiling water for about 8 minutes, and then they're good to go. After that, I usually shock them in ice-cold water to stop the cooking, set the color, and then I'll just give them a quick sauté in some olive oil, and let me tell you, this is good stuff. And my parents love these, so that's how I knew that, you know, they could pass the test of any Southerner, because my parents are pretty strict, you know, they're like harsh critics of food.
Well, as our food writers, one called your cooking Afro-diasporic, because it's not just American soul food. There's fried plantains from the Caribbean, something called vegan Jamaican Ital roasted vegetable stew. The ingredient list is so long, and a couple of them I had a hard time finding. For instance, the 3-inch piece of kombu, which is a Japanese seaweed.
Mm-hmm.
That was tough to find.
Well, you know, the bulk of the recipes, I wanted to ensure that the ingredients were simple, that most people can find them. The kombu, for example, it's nutrient dense. It adds a lot of flavor to whatever recipe you're cooking it with. And so I wanted to help people kind of like push their boundaries and discover new ingredients as well as, you know, helping them use familiar ones.
Well, and another ingredient that you have laced throughout the recipes is agave nectar. It's very sweet. And that is gettable. And is that the substitute for honey or sugar or something sweet?
Well, I always recommend agave nectar as a low glycemic sweetener because, you know, African Americans, unfortunately, are suffering from the highest rates of type 2 diabetes. Mm-hmm. So I suggest agave nectar. It's sweet, it's delicious, and you don't have to worry about that spike in insulin.
Right. And do we understand, too, that many vegans don't eat honey because they feel that it's enslavement of the bees?
Yes. I mean, I have to say I'm not a vegan activist. And to be honest with you, Robin, I really was leery initially about putting vegan in the title. I really didn't want it to scare people off.
So replacing honey with agave nectar. Well, you said you didn't want the veganism to frighten people. Instead, one of our producers was scared out of her wits by mustard seeds. Now, what happened was she was following your recipe and almost, well, she said she almost set her friend's home on fire when she attempted to saute mustard seeds and they immediately exploded like popcorn. Now, this is it was in the roasted yam and mustard green soup, which I have right in front of me, by the way, and I'm going to taste. But, I mean, should she have worn a hockey mask?
maybe, but I think just starting the heat off very low and letting it rise, and just as soon as you start to hear them pop, that's when
you're
you want to pull it off. Yeah.
Well, meanwhile, this is delicious. By the way, the soup is named after your Uncle Don.
Yes.
He's the singer-songwriter whose wife Ann Peebles made a hit out of his song, I Can't Stand the Rain.
I can't stand the rain against my window. Bringing back sweet memories.
As we listen a little of that, tell me, what's happening in the soup?
You can get yams or potatoes really inexpensively, and then a bunch of greens, you know, $1.50, $1.75 at most. And so this is one of those recipes that I like to say is very nutrient dense because of the leafy greens. It's hearty because of the yams. And cutting up some vegetables, roasting them, cooking the greens, sauteing them, and then cooking them in the stock. I think that, you know, it's pretty simple, but I think it's providing people some basic cooking techniques.
Plus, they're listening potentially to great music as they do it, if they get your soundtrack, too. The second recipe she made is the quinoa cornbread, which we have here. The soundtrack is Se Me Van Los Pies by Susana Baca.
Saca la mano, saca los pies, saca la cadera y verás qué rico es.
Oh, this is quite good. Now, tell us more about the cornbread.
Well, you know, cornbread is one of those dishes that people think about when they hear soul food. And I wanted to reinvent this and introduce people to this hearty grain that a lot of people aren't that familiar with, quinoa. It's very high in protein, very nutritious, energizing, and it gives this cornbread some nice crunch. And I've tested every recipe in this book at least 3 times, many of them up to 5, and I ran at least 50% of them by my parents, and this is one of them. I was like, it has to pass the test with them. If they like it, then I'll keep it. If not, I'm X-ing it. So Mama Terry liked it, quinoa cornbread steak.
Bryant Terry, a chef in Oakland, California. His new book is called Vegan Soul Kitchen, Fresh, Healthy, and Creative African-American Cuisine. Bryant, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you, Robin.
Pica la cebolla, ha!
Se me van los pies,
con la cintura,
se me van los pies,
las amacuecas,
se me van.